Hello.
Good evening, George.
Good evening.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
Okay, well, welcome, everyone. Welcome to today's Mastermind with Mr. George Ross. I'm your host, Victor Menashe, Managing Partner of U.S. Real Estate Partners and author of the book Magnetic Capital. It's my extreme pleasure to introduce a man who's done more real estate deals in New York City than anyone else alive today. He's been featured on The Apprentice and the Celebrity Apprentice TV shows as Donald's advisor, both on the show as in real life. He's the author of two best-selling books on real estate and negotiation, taught negotiation at the law school at NYU for over 20 years. Today, very active in philanthropy. He mentors some super fortunate students at Nassau Community College. In business for over 60 years, one of the wisest men I know. Get your pen and pencil and journals ready. We're going to have a great evening. Welcome, George.
Yep, looking forward to it.
We're a few weeks now into a Trump presidency. It's been pretty interesting to watch on the news. What are your thoughts? What would you advise if you were asking this for advice?
Well, you knew there was going to be controversy depending on the whole election. My advice with him is to just stop fighting back. Just let it happen. Let them do with the investigations, whatever they want to do, and just stop defending everything that's going on. You're just adding fuel to the fire, and that's what the news, that's what the media wants. So if you just let things go and say, let's get on to governing and doing what's more important for the country than this, what else is taking back the unhappiness that's surrounding the administration and the president and the Republicans and the Democrats and it's not a waste of time. It's just a total distraction when there's so many more important things to be done. I would tell them to back off.
Right. It's interesting. You know, there's some interesting parallels between what he's doing and, for example, when Rudy Giuliani first took office in New York City, where Rudy put a very strong program in place around, dealing with petty crime, pickpockets, graffiti, things like that, to send a message. And it almost feels like Donald's doing a little bit of the same thing, trying to make a lot of noise around a few specific issues to make a statement. What's your perspective?
It could be. It could be to make a statement. I just think, except that you're in a different arena. You know, every word that comes out of the White House is subject to scrutiny for those that were said, those who were not said, how that you would interpret them. And it's just, you know, there's no definition. It's just an attack on what somebody says, this is what I think he meant or what he didn't mean. There's no way you can win with the press.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're looking
for headlines. That's all. That's how they sell. That's how they sell time and they sell newspapers, and that's what they're looking for. So you can't beat them.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, let's dive into a question around a project. George, this is a project that I have in Louisiana, very close to some oil and gas mega projects. It's on the I-10 corridor that connects Houston with New Orleans. And there's an extreme need for workforce housing. And we're talking about $114 billion of investment over the next decade. And they're out of housing. So what's happening is a number of folks are building RV parks to the extent that they can. The ones that exist are full. We've managed to tie up a piece of property that is entitled for an RV park. It would still need to be built out at about an investment of $2 million to build it out fully. Within 30 days of building it, I'm sure it'll be full. There's a waiting list as long as your arm for RV parks. Now, the wrinkle here is we won't own the land. It's going to be a 15-year land lease.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an attractive business from a cash flow perspective. The $2 million that it'll take to build it out will be repaid in under 2 years. Our annual revenue is going to be in the range of about $1.4 million. The question is this a project that would be bankable? Because it's not a traditional purchase, and if so, how would it be bankable?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing that comes to mind is if a 15-year lease is very short.
Yes.
I mean, can you get an option to renew or something so that you have a longer period of time? Because any bank or any lender is going to say, well, I need more time in the event that something happens in 10 years and I only got 5 years left. What am I going to do?
Well, they're going to get repaid too.
So
what?
No, but it's But you have to think of here you'd have to put your lender's hat on.
Yeah.
And lenders like to know basically that they can recoup their investment over the period of time, and there's enough of a reserve in time so that they have enough time to do it. And
right.
this is pretty short, although the nature of the improvement is not very dramatic. It's it's a trailer park.
Correct.
But basically, I don't know what the improvements are. 2 million in improvements, I assume probably we're talking about some electrical service or
exactly
some water at that point. Just
yeah.
Have it there. Yeah. So that's not spectacular. The numbers that you're talking about, it says, yeah, the numbers make sense, but they're not really bankable as such. But private funding would work, because there's enough leeway there that to get paid back in a relatively short period of time. It would make it attractive for a private lender, assuming that they get some type of a really good rate of return, because you really have nothing in the way of security. I mean, the land is not, there's not a building on it, and the trailer parks are not that highly desirable as an investment vehicle for people. But it does work. It could work, and could work very well. But I think the way to go basically is some type of private funding with either a venture capitalist that would do it, or and some type of a return, which is going to get the money back in a short period of time. So maybe you have to fund it up front a little bit. So it takes more, as the owner at that point, you take less cash initially, but more cash later on down the pike in a couple of years.
Exactly. So we would do a accelerated payback of the lender out of the proceeds, and we would defer our income. Yeah, absolutely. We'd be very comfortable with that.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. That would be attractive.
Now, would we lien the lease, put a mortgage on the lease, and
assign
the rent?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Whatever you'd have to give is security, absolutely. You need to give the security to the lender, whoever's giving you the money.
So the reason for the 15 years is we're not sure that there's a market demand for beyond 15 years, so we don't want to be obligated to paying.
I know that. I'm not saying obligated. I said
option. So maybe
if you get an option, it's say maybe the fair rental value of the space, something along, but something that gives you longevity. If the thing works well, it could work very well. You know, their trailer parks have been in existence for many, many years, and this could certainly work.
Yes.
Depending upon the demand, and the demand looks to be there from what you're telling me.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's a funny community. I mean, you know, when you're surrounded by literally almost $100 billion worth of mega projects that really don't demand long-term permanent housing, but we're talking about close to 50,000 temporary construction workers that need a place to live.
Yep. No, it's an intriguing situation for sure, and could be done, but it's way off the beaten path, as you know.
Yeah. It's definitely not in the middle of the snake zone for sure.
No.
Okay. Very good. So the next question comes from Stefan Arneau. Stefan, are you on the line? No, if he's not, we'll come back to him.
Okay.
Tammy, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, George. It's good to get to visit with
you
again. I'm wonderful.
Good.
Thank you very much. Hey, I had the pleasure of hearing you speak several years ago, and you were talking about prioritization, and some of your words have been echoing in my head, but I thought I could benefit from revisiting the topic, and maybe our listeners could as well. I wondered what your strategy is for handling all the influx of information that comes in, emails, documents, requests, and how you prioritize those.
That happens to be an excellent question, because it's with everything that's created, all the data and everything that comes in on a daily basis, you do get inundated with a lot of useless data that you don't even need. And then do you spend time reading it and then you throw it out, or you don't, you say, is this really important? And time management is really critical. And this falls into the category of time management. What I've done, first of all, there's a rule which everybody should know, and this is absolutely inviolate. It's called the 80-20 rule. The 80-20 rule is 20% of what you do is going to get you 80% of your income. And that's for sure. So what you have to do is to concentrate on the 20%, because that'll get you the maximum. Forget the rest of the stuff. Because if you never got to it, it's no big deal. But if you don't get to the critical 20%, you're in big trouble. So what I always did is the following. I made up three files. A, B, C. Everything that was important, that had to be done in a short period of time, went into the A file. Everything that didn't have a time frame, a critical time frame at this, but could be put off or was relatively unimportant, went into the C file. And everything else went into the B file. If I didn't know it should be A or C, it went into the B. Sooner or later, it will either become an A or a C. But what this does is it forces you to focus on that which is important. If you do everything and you concentrate on everything that's in your A file, you've solved the bulk of your problem, because that's where your income or your money or your business is really, really concerned. So that's basically the key. And it does work.
Excellent. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, it does. It does work well. Just getting in the habit, and you got to go through the A file as quickly as possible, and you put in there that everything that's required. In other words, to for your business or how you're going to make the most money, and then the rest of it you get to later on.
Right.
So
thank you so much.
Try it. I think it works very well.
Well, I remember there were three piles, but I really appreciate you revisiting it. That and I was like, so lately I've been thinking, what would George do? And so,
well, the other thing is, depending upon your organization, and I don't know how many people are involved, and there are probably a lot of people that are on the call have a big organization. When something comes in, you should say, is this something that I should be doing myself, or can I delegate it? And if you can delegate it, delegate it. So you have to make that consideration, as you can figure out less that you're going to put into the A pile because you can delegate it, then your task of keeping current becomes a lot easier.
Great.
So, George, just to clarify, I mean, oftentimes, and I think Stephen Covey talks about this, urgency can often masquerade for importance. So it's really focusing on the things that fit within that 80-20, where the criteria is importance, not urgency.
That's correct. And that's also important when you put in the A. That doesn't mean that you just start at the first. You prioritize what's in the A file so that you get to the most important item first, the second most important second, so that your main topic that you're looking at is the one that's most important. And then you go through it and do it that way. So a lot of people, one of the fallacies is they don't prioritize things that come in. They just throw it in and say, well, this has got to be done. I got to do this, without figuring out what should come first and what's the most important. So you have to prioritize and then go through the items that are most important to you first until you get to the bottom. But you may have a whole bunch of them that have a short time frame.
That's awesome. Okay. The next question is from Sergey. Sergey, you're on the line?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi, how are you, Sergey?
I'm very good. It's my first time on my first question.
Well, let's hope it's not the last time. What can I do for you?
I have a business question for you. My company is in business of managed information technology services. So my company was also awarded the IT Company of the Year award for this year.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you. In our city, Ottawa, which is 1.2 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem I have is that I'm leasing business class computers to my clients as part of my packages to them.
Mm-hmm.
By supplying the computers, I can guarantee the quality of the service they will get.
Right.
The computers don't break, and they're professionally managed.
Mm-hmm.
So the fixed configuration means I have perfect control over the quality.
That's important.
Yes, thanks. With each new client, I need to buy a new computer. And it gets repaid on 2-year cycle and gets replaced on a 4-year cycle.
Right.
So theoretically, I'm making 50% profit on the hardware life cycle and 25% profit on annualized basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that I'm financing it all myself. I can easily see that a situation where my growth will consume too much cash. So the more I grow, the more cash it will consume in the short term. So my question is, how would you suggest that I finance the growth?
That's a good question. Well, financing the growth is important. But there are companies that do this, that do equipment financing of all kinds, and that's short-term or long-term. And what you're talking about here, computers, certainly equipment that can be financed over a period of time. So that somebody pays for it and buys it. This is some there are companies that do it. For example, a lot of equipment that goes into doctor's offices that they can't buy it. So they basically lease it, agree to pay it back. But there are companies that will buy it for them and lease it to them. And that's basically what you have here. Now, what I'm also thinking of is, you should be taking a tremendous tax advantage here as your computers become obsolete. You can write them off. It's part of your business. So you should be writing them off on a relatively short period of time, which will give you certainly a lot more available income that you won't have to worry about paying a tax on it. So I hope you're taking advantage of that. If not, you should take advantage of that.
Okay. That's a good thought. Absolutely.
Yeah, and the equipment. There are companies that do financing, that do that type of financing, and you can you'd have to look at where it is in Ottawa, but they look at a company that does financing of equipment, and this fits. And they do airplanes, they do cars, they do trucks, and they certainly would do computers. It doesn't make a difference the nature of the financing of or what the equipment is. It's just how it's being used and repaid.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next question is from Mathieu Lacaire. And Mathieu messaged me just a couple of minutes ago. He could not make the call. So I'll ask the question on his behalf.
All right.
So he has a building, it's a sixplex in eastern Canada, and he's looking to put some financing on the building. The problem he's having is that the lenders don't like the location, so he's had several refusals in a row. It looks like the banks have essentially blacklisted that particular neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So he's looking to raise some capital, improve his liquidity. His alternative is to sell the building. If the banks have blacklisted it, you know, he can go the route of a private financing, maybe pay a premium rate of interest. The cash flow can certainly support it. The problem is, you know, if the neighborhood's been blacklisted and he goes to refinance in 2 or 3 years, he's going to face the same issue. What would you suggest? Should he just dump it and potentially take a loss? Should he?
No, dumping it is not the answer at this point. You know, sort of things got good possibilities. I resist this concept of basically it's blacklisted and it will stay blacklisted forever.
Mm-hmm.
That any areas do change. They may not be desirable for banks to put the money in, but that doesn't mean the area itself can't self-sustain itself. What I am questioning is whether or not he can't go to the municipality where it's located or some chamber of commerce and say, look, at this, I have to have some government approval. Government approval, or maybe I get them to give a partial guarantee. It's certainly desirable to what he's doing is very desirable, taking a neighborhood which is less than desirable at the time, and making it better by building on it and improving it. So that you should be able to get some kind of a backing from the municipality or from the state or from the county.
Yeah, the municipality.
I would certainly go that route.
They've been supportive. They've had press conferences and had the aldermen all that good stuff.
I'm talking about the press conference. What I'm talking about that they would go on the hook in some way.
Right.
So they may float a bond issue or a partial bond issue or give an individual a partial guarantee of the loan, something that's going to make the bank happy, so that they'll go along with the fact that it's in a less desirable neighborhood, but something that some type of a guarantee, which is very often do you find in the where you have a loan which is being made on property which the lender is not happy with, so he has somebody guarantee the repayment of the loan. Either in whole or in part or over a period of time, some type of that, and I think it's doable. I wouldn't. The loss is not there. That you can always go along with a higher interest rate, or go with a secondary lender.
Yeah,
not necessarily a bank, but someone a secondary lender. But of course, the interest rate goes higher, and I don't know what you're talking about. But it's there's always somebody who's willing to loan money if the rate is right.
He can certainly tolerate a higher interest rate. It's throwing off a lot of cash, and so even 10%, he'll still be positive cash flow. So
yeah, well, good. There are lots of lenders, lots of venture capitalists that are willing to make loans at 10%. That's a good rate of return.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's working in the secondary market.
Yeah. Okay, the next question is from Leon. Leon, are you on the line? I don't hear Leon. Okay, I'll find out where he is. Okay, so Steph and Arnie, are you on the line yet? Okay, I will ask Stefan's question. His question is around the concept of reinvention, and some entrepreneurs and business people have reinvented themselves multiple times during their careers, many of them achieving breakout success in that process. What's your philosophy, George, about when to stay the course, stick to fundamentals, and when to consider reinventing yourself? What are signs that it's time for reinvention?
Well, that's a good question, a very good question, especially in today's day and age, because things change so dramatically and so quickly. It's not a question in my mind. Don't talk about reinventing. It's talk about keeping current with what's going on in the industry, whatever the industry may be. So if look at other companies that are there, where are they going? And then decide, is there still a future in what you're doing? Is it something which is going to change dramatically over a period of time or shortly? You have to take all of that into consideration and you decide. It's not reinventing, it's keeping current. For example, looking at keeping current, that you have the, I have someone who was very, very into technology. And he said to me, he's very much into technology, in the manufacturing end of it. And he said to me, George, if you have a granddaughter who's going to college now, in 3 years, 85% of everything she is using will be obsolete. Not out of date, obsolete. Which means that whatever is in there at that point has effectively no more than a 3-year life. And this, as you can see, look at Apple. Apple, what are they called? They got to come out with an iPhone 6, 7, whatever it is. They always have to come out with a new product to basically keep up with it, so that's the way they're going to generate the sales. And probably the best name, look at Kodak. Kodak at that point disappeared. Why? Because Polaroid came in. What happened to Polaroid? Polaroid disappeared. Why? Because you had digital photography. So anyone that's in that industry, that's unaware of the trend that's going on and the knowledge has got a problem. So the key really is to be aware of what's going on in your particular city, in your particular area, and then adapt what you do to taking into account that there may be a change taking place, and you figure out is it subtle or is it short, and it's a communication problem. But with everything is there now, you got so much information that's available that you can do it to keep it better. It's not reinventing, it's bringing yourself up to date.
I like that perspective. Makes a lot of sense. Neil Cobain talks about this concept of intentional congruence.
But there's also there's a corollary to what we're saying is, hey, there may come a time when you say, yeah, the business is on its way out at that point. I got to get out of it. It has no real future. Therefore, I have to get out of it before it's total catastrophe. So knowing when to give up something that's not working is fine. There's a perfect example of what's going on now with the big box stores. In other words, you know, the department stores like Macy's and whatever. Most of the sales, a good part of the sales now, are online. So people buying online, they don't go to the stores. Why does the company still have to have a major a store in an area where it's not sustained from the customers? So there's a perfect example of it. It has to be a change in philosophy. You're not going to eliminate the stores, but you're certainly going to cut down the number of them and the number of employees because the source of your income has changed dramatically.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly. This next question is from Leon. Leon, go ahead.
Yeah,
Leon.
Okay, there we go. Sorry about that. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. My question is centered around family. Donald Trump is able to work with his children and have them involved in his organization, whether it be business or political. Family businesses have a history that can be very rocky. What has Donald done to build a successful family business environment?
Well, that's a very, very good question, but it's not – I think you're looking at it or maybe in a different light than what it is in. Donald controls the business. The children don't control the business. He tells the kids – he tells them that boy what he wants done and how he wants it handled. It's a total dictatorship. It's not a democracy, and that's the way with a family business. It should be a total dictatorship, not a democracy. So that somebody in charge, whoever it may be, has the major interest and says, this is what we're going to do, and there is no disagreement with that. The family can't stop it and can't tie it up because you're going to have too many disputes of different ideas. Some wants income immediately, some wants long-term growth, some wants to get out in 5 years, some wants sell. You can't run it as a democracy. A family business run as a democracy is doomed for failure or doomed for controversy, not necessarily failure.
Too many chefs in the kitchen, basically.
That's correct.
Interesting.
So that's what you have.
So your main over his philosophy is let's run this as a dictatorship. I tell you what to do. And do you feel – but they're very strong leaders in what they do. Or
well,
am
you
I
can
just,
tell
is this
you
the
what
perception
I say,
that we
he,
have?
Yeah, but he can tell you, it's not a question to tell you what to do. He can set the parameters of exactly what the environment is that they have to operate in. And that's the vision. Say, hey, good. When we go, this is how we're going to invest in a building. This is what you're going to do. And this, so he can let them run, but he set the game plan as to exactly what they're doing. And they can't vary from the game plan.
Do you ever feel
the individual situation could do it?
Do you ever feel there will be an age where it comes where he says, okay, I do not do parameters, either Ivanka or somebody else now takes the Trump head and runs?
Yes.
In your opinion, when do you think or who do you think would lead that?
I think he's already done it.
Interesting. And that's with Ivanka?
I think he's already done it. I think at that point, I think he's come to a point to say, I have enough money and enough income in what I have. I'm not looking for more. You can take the properties the way they are and run them from now. Run them forward.
Interesting. So my second part question is, I am a new parent. I have two young boys, the oldest being a year and a half. So what I would like to see is, what is your own parenting advice for someone who is looking to raise strong, successful children And where is it, you know, you give them the freedom, but then you also add direction?
Well, that's a tough question, because it's very, depends on the individual, depends on the family. It's difficult. But I would say at a fairly early age, you get them involved in your business or your life, is how you make your money or how you support yourself, and to indicate to them that in order to do it, you got to work hard and you have to do things, and teach them the value of money, and also get the thrill of performance, so that if they do something that they get, then they do it and it's successful, they get you commend them for that. So it's basically teaching them the basics of the business, but it depends on the age and to when they understand it. But you can start fairly early, but you just build it up a little as they can take, you know, understand it. So it really depends over a period of time. But I would also teach them, one of the things I can think as far as parenting is concerned, is I think it's very important for a parent to teach their children that there's a balance in life. And they say the balance is important. On one side, you have the money, or the aspect of what I need to live on, or what my desires are and the style I want to live. And the other aspect has to do with the family, with the environment, with the church or whatever it is, or charities. And that part is also has to be taken into account, because if you have both of them in balance, it's fine. If one goes out of balance, then the basis for being unhappy. And you want certainly every parent wants its child to be happy.
Thank you very much. And if just for 30 seconds we can touch on this, because it goes along with the children, the wife. I have my wife, and you know, one big key that we had always advisors around us tell us is always be on the same page, be evolving together. What is your secret to keeping that long? I mean, you've been married, I don't know, sorry, I can't quote how long, but very long time. Yeah. Were you able to do that too long?
Well, it's the main thing is discussion. In other words, you have discussions.
Like weekly meetings, or
No. Tell you what you need. It's not weekly meetings. Nothing is there. But whenever something arises up that's going to affect the marriage or going to affect the income or whatever, then you basically sit down and talk. But not where the children are there and involved. It's private.
And
you come up with a court. You come up with an understanding. This is what we're going to do, and both parties subscribe to it.
Were you ever a person who believed in sharing some of the either financially, some of the direction that the family was taking or things, just to get them involved, to understand how money works and finances work and decisions inside of family? So maybe one day they'll glean from that when they do it.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Perfect.
Especially as you get older, at this point, it becomes more important that the children or the rest of the family have some knowledge of what you do and what they're faced going on in the future. It's as life progresses, the problems become different, and as you get older, they're not your problems anymore. They ultimately are theirs. So the more guidance you can give them to face that issue is great.
Right, because I know some friends of mine, their family was very secretive, and then when they grew up, they actually didn't know how to do some things finance, right?
Terrible. No, they should be, all your children, when they go up, they should be computer literate. They should know, read. Let them work on Google. Let them work on, get as much information as they can as to what's going on in the world. They should know politics. They should be exposed to politics, exposed to money, exposed to all of the things that go on in the world that make the business world at the earliest stage, because you can't just jump into it.
I don't want to interrupt Victor, but what motivated you when you were under 30? That is a very big something that I've always wanted to know.
Yes, okay. What motivated me when I was under 30? At that point, I was very poor. I had no money of any kind, and I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be there again. I have to figure out how I'm going to make money, and when I make it, I'm going to figure out how to use it wisely, and I'm going to provide a safety net for my wife and for my children, and that was my primary goal. That I would, if you're a lawyer, which I was for many years, you're going to make a lot of money. The question is, you can make more by investing, so that you can use that for the future. But still, you have to have some kind of a game plan. and I always had a game plan as to where, how much money I wanted for what period of time and what my expenses were and how do I get there. And if my expenses exceeded my income, I had to cut down the expenses or build up
the
income.
Thank you very much, George. I hope to talk to you again soon.
You're welcome. Great.
Actually, George, that raises an interesting question. When you were looking for more income, what did you do? Did you come up with a particular goal that was, let's say, much higher than your current income? And you said, well, I have no idea how I'm going to get it done, but you set a specific number? Or did you simply try and grow incrementally on, say, a percentage basis? Maybe I want 10% more. How did you do that?
No, that's a good question. No, I always had set a number. In other words, when I would come up and periodically say, well, what number, how much income do I need on an annual basis to give me the lifestyle that I want? And we pick our own lifestyle. And then when you come with that number, then you say, okay, here's where I am. Here's where I am now. Here's how much income I have. Figure out all your expenses. And you say, am I short or do I have an excess? If I have an excess, then what you're going to do is you're going to figure out what you're going to do with the excess. All right. Now you can invest the excess. All right. If you're on the other hand, you're not. If you're short, then you figure out I got to cut down the expenses or figure out how to make more income. And something you adjust every year.
George, this next question is something that came up literally today. We've got a property that we are considering putting on the market, and we've been in discussions with a broker. Over the weekend, the broker whispered something to somebody we've done business with before. In fact, they built some buildings for us. And that party approached us today and is placing an offer on that property. Somebody we already knew. We don't have a signed agreement with the broker yet, although we intend to. Question is, should the broker be entitled to anything at this point?
The broker entitled to anything? Yeah, the answer is yes if the broker has made the connection. The answer is yes. But you make a deal. It could be less, but you can make a deal with the broker and say, you know, hey, we knew these people, so instead of getting a usual commission, if the deal closes that way, you get X percent, and you do it. But the answer is, yeah, deal with the broker. Don't try to cut the broker out completely.
That makes perfect sense. That's actually where we were headed anyway, with the saying, okay, we haven't signed a listing agreement.
No, but it's still a finder's fee. The fact that you haven't signed a listing agreement is plus somebody brought you a buyer.
Exactly. That makes perfect sense. I'm sure this is a situation that comes up all the time. Next question, George, is we're dealing with a new business model. We have a number of folks who are physicians, relatively new to real estate, and they're interested in doing something. The characteristic is they generally have a lot of cash, next to no time, and they want to learn. And for them to take down an entire building themselves is probably too much. So we've come up with the concept of almost an investment club where we would pull together 8 or 10 doctors, plus myself and perhaps one other principal in a company for the purpose of providing both education as well as an investment vehicle. We have 8 to 10 doctors who are bringing both talent, some time, some money, all together, but they would not be passive investors. They would be active investors. What do you think of the concept?
Well, the concept is a good concept. It's not new. Syndication is effectively syndication in one form or another, which has certainly been around forever. The concept is good. First of all, understand the deal. Doctors are the worst investors in the world. They're the worst business people. They really don't know. They know they're fine in their practice and how much money that they make and whatnot. But when it comes to investments, they're absolute babes in the woods. So you have to lead them. And there's nothing to say that you can't lead them, and they shouldn't be part of a syndicate or a club, as you call it, where somebody or some group that knows what they're doing decides what investments this club or we'll call or the company decides that they're going to go in. But you can't have you can't let the doctors, whoever it is, make the decisions as to work. They're not capable of it. They're the worst business people in the world. Trust me. All right. So the concept that you have that they're going to put in some money on an initial basis or over a period of time and bring a certain amount of capital, that's fine. And you can structure a partnership agreement or a syndication agreement in which all of that is taken care of and they're responsible for it. But when it comes to making the actual decisions of the investment or what goes, they can be contacted, but they're not controlling. You can't let the inmates run the asylum.
Well, this is precisely why I was asking the question. wasn't the answer I was expecting, which is fantastic. What you're saying is treat it more like a traditional syndication.
Right. It's traditional syndication, but also what you can do is to keep to do it, keep the investment separate. So each investment which is done, what property or whatever is involved, is in a separate LLC. So that if that went bad, it doesn't affect the syndication itself. So it's like this is like a subsidiary entity, but it's not really not anything that would affect the parent. And you could have the different types of investments. It doesn't have to be the same type of investment. It could be different investments in different parts of the city. It could be multi. Could be residential housing. Could be commercial in some sort. Could be almost any type. Could be ground leases. It gives you you have the flexibility, and the members would have an interest in all of those, but okay. not the control. Not to tell you, yeah.
So
remain in people who know what they're doing.
So create a limited partnership. I think the lenders would require each building, say if it's a medical office building, to be in its own entity anyway, so it's firewalled from the other investments. We would make the professional management of each of the buildings. The limited partners would not be members as such, but limited partners in the limited partnership, and that's where the syndication would occur at that level, at the LP level.
Right, and then also at that point, it's good if you're in drafting the agreement, some type of a buyout arrangement. In other words, some type of a divorce. So if which makes it more attractive for the investors. So if they want it out, how do they get out?
Right.
They could offer it to the other partners, in which case the other partners would pay for it, not necessarily in cash, or that they could sell it to a third party who doesn't have any control. So it just makes it more attractive as a vehicle.
Well, my initial thought was to almost treat it not as a security by considering all the doctors to be active investors, not passive. But what you're saying is...
No, you don't want them active investors.
That's a bad idea.
That's a terrible idea. Because they're not real estate or investment savvy.
Yeah.
They're only know what their particular profession and how they make the money. And it's true, they do make a lot of money. And they are a wonderful source of income or potential investors, no question about it, but not for them to control. So you have to be satisfied that you have a group that has the control, is doing it, that knows what they're doing. So they have to be satisfied with that, but that's not them.
Right.
So it could be two or three individuals or a group that makes the decision so that they don't feel they're out of control, but they don't really control.
Exactly.
They feel that somebody's there watching out for their interests. And they can vary because the investments could vary. Some are long-term growth, some are income. The real estate and investments take a whole different spectrum of possibilities. So they should be aware of it and have the right to participate in it, but they don't control it.
That makes perfect sense. Well, very good. The next question is from Mark Kenny, and he wasn't able to make it. He was tied up all day in depositions, and he's done a number of multifamily projects. Historically, they've used a very traditional model where they, as the principals, are taking a 20% carried interest in the deal, and they're providing 80% to the equity investors. Now, they have a new project that's not a traditional purchase. What they will be doing is buying some partners out of an existing limited partnership. And as a result, the deal structure is going to be different. This isn't really so much of a legal question, but more a question of if you have an existing community of investors that are used to a certain model, how do you get them used to this different model? Or are they tainted, poisoned for life, if you will, stuck on that model, and we may have to go for different investors? That's what I think he's asking. How does he position this with his existing investors?
Yeah, the change is you may have to go for different investors, but you may also have the existing investors. But the model is going to be different. If they're going to get bought out at a period of time, or they know they're going to get bought out, or they get some kind type of benefits, a partial buyout, they get guaranteed income, or they sit subordinate to other income. And it depends on the nature of the investment. So they have to be educated as the nature of the investment. When you talk partnership, there are partnerships of all kinds. So it depends on the nature of the investment and what they're looking for in the partnership. Are they looking for long-term growth, short-term income? Are they looking for a divorce method where they can get out? Are they looking to get bought out? And one of the important elements of that type of a partnership is some type of a divorce proceeding, so that if the partners decide, the bulk of the partners decide to go in one direction, and somebody says, no, I'm not going that direction, you have a method of controlling that party who says, I'm not going in that direction. Either they don't participate or you buy out their share on some type of an equitable basis.
Well, George, when you had the radio stations in your portfolio, you ended up going through a negotiation that progressed over time with different buyout terms over time. Would you advise taking that approach in negotiating on the back end, or would you advise papering it up in advance?
You never negotiate on the back end. That's suicidal.
Okay.
You negotiate at the front end. In other words, whatever it is at that point, you have to do it in a way. When there is no money involved, it's easy to make a deal. When there is money involved, it's hard to make a deal because people look at a different perspective at a different point in time. So now you can build in a provision where you buy it out at a certain percentage, a certain value or formula on how much income comes in or when it's coming in, and you pay it out over a period. There are all types of ways, but you have to have some type of a buyout provision, a divorce provision in any type of agreement. And when you have that divorce provision, at that point, that governs it. But the time is at the beginning. When you draft it, that's the time it works, because then nobody is affected and say it's going to hurt me. When the time comes that there is money on the table, and now you try to go back and tell somebody what to do or how to do it, that's when the fun starts, because now they say, well, I put in more money, I put in more time, it becomes a mess that usually ends up in litigation.
How would you address the potential objection that a bio provision in the PPM caps the upside potential for the investor?
Why would you cap the upside potential?
Basically, what you're saying is if the project is too successful.
Well, yeah, but they should say in that case you give them a little more.
Okay.
So you now provide that. Well, if we're selling out and we get this amount, this is what this amount, which is not that, which is really not a great profit, this is what you get. If we turn out, it turns out to be a larger success, you get more, but not all of it. Your rate goes higher. Your return goes higher.
Okay. So let's say
you can structure it over a period of time.
All right. Let's say, for example, a partner says, I want out, and I've found somebody to step into my place, and I want to sell my shares at X dollars. Would you put a provision in there in the limited partnership that the limited partnership has a right of first refusal to buy out that partner?
Absolutely. That you can do, and he shouldn't object to it.
Right.
Because he's going to get the exact same money regardless.
All he's looking for is just making a sell out and buy. You should have the right to buy at the same price or during that they're ready to sell, without a doubt.
Then the partnership itself would have an option to buy out under a predetermined set of conditions.
Correct.
Okay.
And then at that point, if the partnership doesn't want to buy out, one of the partners could buy out.
George, that makes very good sense. Very, very good.
That they can. One of the partners can decide, I want to. I like it. I would increase my share. And so that's a method of doing it. But it doesn't change the control situation. It doesn't change the control. It just can change the amount of equity that's involved or the percentage share.
Yes.
Whoever had the control before had it when it starts out, that's what it is.
Okay, in the closing minutes here, we're going to wrap up with a segment that we're calling Behind the Apprentice Boardroom. And I really like The Apprentice for the fact that there are some tremendous business lessons in the show. One of the things that I think made the show very appealing, and it was certainly appealing to me for that quality, let's focus on the concept of leadership. A lot of times when people got fired in the boardroom, it's because they did not exercise leadership, or if they did exercise leadership, they did it the wrong way. They were too autocratic or not inclusive enough. Can you give an example and focus specifically on this concept of layered leadership, and maybe you decide who would be the best example of that?
Well, not the best example. The whole concept of the apprentice was based on leadership. In other words, you always have project manager.
Yeah.
And the project manager at that point who had the prime responsibility for whatever the task was. And that, as far as the project manager was concerned, yes, it has to be make it clear that they are the leader. And they can give certain elements of the project to other people. But that doesn't mean that the other people control the project by any means. You have to say, look, fellas, and there's one referee, and that's me. So when the decision to be made, I'm the one that's got my neck on the block. If it doesn't work, I'm the one that's going to get fired, so therefore you got to listen to me. And that is very important. Now, that's important in any business. Now, another element which is important is that in order to be a good leader, you have to learn how to listen. Now, when I say listen, I'm not talking about hearing. I'm talking about listening. So you have to, when someone talks, whoever it is that you're getting involved with this, you have to understand not only what they are saying, but what are they not saying. And you have to get to know them. And then once you do that, then you can basically figure out how to be a leader, how to be a good leader. Because a good leader must know what's going on in the minds of all those that are subordinate to him or her. And the only way you can do that is through frank discussions. And a lot of times we didn't have it, and certainly on The Apprentice at that point, this is where things fell apart, that this when there was a task that didn't get fulfilled, and the leader, the project manager, was criticized, the first thing he did, the first people that threw him to the wolves were the underlings.
Right.
Can you relate a story of an example where it was done particularly well? One person that comes to mind is Sean Yazbek, who actually went on.
I said, yeah, I know Sean. I read a bit about him. Fine, but actually, he came after me.
That's great.
Yeah, so it wasn't really really part of it, but the others that came to mind, certainly Bill Rancic who was the first apprentice was probably the outstanding example. Is he knew how to relate to people. He knew how to get them to work with him and for him at that point. But making it a team effort, even though he was the leader. And as time went on, that was to his benefit, because effectively he was only trying. All of the contestants were just trying to stay on not to get fired.
Right.
And now you have to protect yourself to say, okay, I may be a leader or I may be involved, but I want to make sure that I'm not the next one that gets fired. So therefore, I have to build a camaraderie with all of the other contestants, all of the other people. And it's that camaraderie or the feelings, you know what they are because you've spoken to them and you can make certain assessments as to what attracts them and what turns them off. And that's the key. And that's the key of all leadership in any event. You have to know the people that you're leading or they're working for you or with you. And that's if you do it, you're going to be successful. If you don't, you're doomed to failure. Okay, you raised the term. You said layered leadership.
Yes.
That doesn't work. It's not layers. If it's different, giving to people different parts of a project, that's fine. So in that element, with that part of the project, they may have a degree of control. But when it comes to, it's not the overall project by any means.
Right. Obviously, there's going to be a time where you don't want every single decision bubbling to the top of the house.
You got it.
Right.
Absolutely right.
We're just about at the top of the hour here. George, as always, thank you so much for your wisdom and for sharing your time with us.
And my pleasure.
We are scheduled for next month. I believe it's already posted on the website in the schedule. Again, thank you very much, George. You have a great evening.
But okay. Get more questions coming and more problems. More things, we'll try to help you solve them.